Great, thank you. Well, I was asked by Cliff earlier this week to give a what's called a Way-Seeking Mind talk. And it's the first talk given by somebody, usually people who live here. Is that correct, Cliff? That's a kind of custom here. And it's kind of an introduction to everyone, where I come from, who I am, practice, share my practice a bit. And so what I'd like to do for you guys is just tell you a little bit of background about myself, but also something that's very important to me and has also been very uncomfortable with me in my practice is working with the posture and working with the body. So I'd like to speak about that a little bit. I have a background in Qigong practice. I started Qigong before I started Zen practice. And that and also a background in fitness and body awareness practices in general. So I think you bring who you are to your practice, and I definitely do, and that's part of what I bring. So that's what I'd like to share with you too. But I started my practice as a child. I was raised Catholic, and my parents would do bedtime prayers with me every night, and I remember we would include several family members and specific family members in our prayers. You know, at the end we would say like, God bless grandma and grandpa so-and-so and all our aunts and uncles and cousins and friends. And then at the end we would say everyone in the whole world, and we'd do this. I don't know how we started that, but my sister and I would do this. And when I did that, I visualized the whole world right here with me. And then went back into my prayer position with my hands. And ending every night with that kind of instilled something in me. And my father sometimes would just say, Andy, what's the most important thing? What's the most important thing? And I would think, and I'd sit there and I'd feel. And finally my answer was love. And he said, yes. So I think that's when my practice really started. And because after I kind of had my, I think I put in my bio, my amicable breakup with theism in my teens, it didn't work for me. And I know it worked for a lot of people, and it definitely worked for people in my family, or it seemed to anyway. But it didn't work for me. And then I was adrift for a while. And I was reading things like Nietzsche and a bunch of other philosophers and stuff. And it was kind of frightening. And yet it was also comforting that there's other possibilities than what I'd believed my entire life. But it was also very frightening. Kind of a classic kind of crisis point. But at some point in philosophy class at community college, my teacher started to bust out Taoism and Buddhism and just started drafting it up on the board. And he wrote really good pictures, and he kind of just had this way of talking where he'd almost hypnotize you in this very open state because he just had this nice deep voice, and he just had this way of speaking about something, and you had no idea what his position was on it, but he presented it so fully. And so he presented Taoism, and then he presented Buddhism and the Four Noble Truths. And when Buddhism came around, I just had this feeling like, this is the way I relate to life. You know, working with suffering and what causes suffering and how does one relate to that? And what's possible other than suffering or just, you know, feeling part of the painful aspect of our existence. And so that led me straight into exploring. I'd been doing some Qigong at that point, and Qigong is kind of a Chinese sort of yogic system, I guess you could say. It's working with the body, working with qi or energy. But I started seeking out Buddhist centers, and I was like, well, there's got to be people who practice this stuff. You know, I was a white boy from the northern suburbs of Minneapolis, and it was so far away from Buddhism as you could possibly get in the United States. Christianity was everywhere, and but Buddhism seemed like it was a long ways away, and that there wasn't anybody doing this. So I started driving into the city. I was about 20 years old, and I was on a mission to meet real live Buddhists. And I did finally. And one of the first people I met was this guy named Bob Brown at a Shambhala center, and who now goes by the name of Sokuzan, and is in actually this same tradition of Kogen Shinran Roshi's lineage teaching out in Michigan. But he was in Minneapolis at the time, and he just seemed like a regular kind of working class guy, you know, with a flannel shirt. And we just sat down, we started talking. And he had a Wednesday night group, and we studied every Wednesday. We would sit for an hour, and if you had any questions about practice, you could meet with him. In this tradition, we call it like Dokusan, or we can meet about practice. But there, it's just a meditation interview. And I also started going to a Zen center and met a guy named Mike Dosho Port, or Dosho Mike Port, who's a student of Katagiri Roshi. Katagiri Roshi started the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center out in Minneapolis. So it was these two I started doing dual. You know, Shambhala kind of has a Tibetan style, but also its own kind of secularish kind of teachings on basic human dignity and how to become awake. And Zen just had this appeal to me because it had this tenacity of practice. You know, the first time I showed up to the center, we sat facing a wall for 40 minutes. I'd never done that in my entire life. And so I was like, well, maybe I should start taking some classes on this. And they had a very user-friendly, it was a very lively, large sangha at the time in St. Paul, Minnesota. And so I did this introduction to Sesshin. Sesshin is one day or several days of retreat. I did one of those, did several days of that, and kept going, and kept doing what was called the Shambhala training. That brought me out to Colorado eventually, where I went to Naropa University to study Buddhism, transpersonal psychology, and kind of body-based psychotherapy. And eventually, in Colorado, I met all kinds of teachers. In Boulder, it was just all kinds of Tibetan teachers and everything like that. And what I began to find, one teacher who particularly made a very strong impression was Kogen Shinran Roshi. I met him at Shambhala Center, Shambhala Mountain Center, in 2002, and just the end of June or beginning of July. And we were on retreat, and this Japanese Zen master was going to come and speak with us. And I had some sense of who he was, and he was teaching at Naropa. I was very excited to practice with him. And he came and spoke with us, and I had a sense that I really wanted to spend time with this man, not just based on what he said, but what I felt. That same sense of openness that my father and my mother helped instill in us every night, I felt completely with him. There was no difference, and it actually expanded it. My grandfather too was very emotional, and I had a moment with him before he died in the hospital, where he said, "The most important thing we can do in our life is to love each other." And this Japanese Zen master gave a talk to us. We met him on the grounds and at this Shinto kind of shrine that honors kind of feminine nature energy. And he taught us how to relate to that energy anywhere, whether it's in a forest or whether it's in somewhere in our lives. And he gave us this practice. This is what Kogen taught us, was putting our hands together like this and just clapping gently twice and bowing and clapping gently twice. And so this and this came together for me. And he had a way of speaking about things that were disparate that brought everything together. And that's what I experienced with him. And so that is what has led me continually into Zen, I would say, is began when I was a child, and it continues now. And Koban is the founder of Jikoji here as well. And he died weeks later after I met him. And there's a sense of brokenheartedness for me in that. And that is now part of my practice. But Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who founded Shambhala, and I was doing that for a long time, talks about the tender heart of sadness as being a component of an awakened heart and of being awake and brokenheartedness. Pema Chodron speaks about this a lot in her books too, if several of you have read her. What is it to have a genuinely broken heart? What is it to hold the world? These are things that keep bringing me back to Zen practice. And I feel it right now, just speaking with it and sharing with you guys. There's a tenderness in there for me, and it feels personal, but more than just personal. And so the form that we do here, the sitting practice, for me, is a way to sit, just as Koban said famously, like our lives, there's so much here, you know. So there's something about this quote, and it's on the website. Joe put it on the website, man. So naturally, we just sit down for a while. So we sit here, and there's like this containment in this posture. And for me, it's this constant feeling of breaking open. And all the stingy ways that I defend myself over time can't really maintain themselves. And so I'd like to just share a couple of aspects of how I relate to posture. So in finding a sitting posture, it's classically, what's one classical text or reference is what's called the Sevenfold Posture of Vairochana. And these are the aspects of legs crossed, but I think that you can really expand upon that, that the legs are worked with in a chair. A lot of times they're just, your knees are slightly below your hips, so you work with yourself with what you need. I don't think it matters if you're on the floor or if you're in a chair. I think comfort is important. Spine is straight, and not rigidly straight and literally straight, but it has a natural curvature, and laterally it's straight. As straight as you can get it. I have scoliosis myself, and I've had surgeries. So, in my sternum area and chest, so I just work with how I can get myself as straight as possible. Shoulders are even and relaxed. It's 0.3. The chin is tucked slightly under. It's very slight. The hands in this text are in the gesture of equanimity, one hand on top of the other, and we do this with the thumbs touching. The tongue is on the tip of the mouth, or the tongue tip is on touching your palate on the top of your mouth, just behind the teeth. And the lips slightly open, slightly closed. And one thing that I work with this one is that we talk about our thumbs barely touching as if you could put a piece of paper between them. And the tongue is like that for me too. I find that if what's happening with the posture for me reflects very closely the mind. And I'll be pursing my lips at times if I'm thinking very hard. I'll be cranking my neck a certain way or really trying to meditate very hard or something. Or I'm distracted and my thumbs just start doing this, or I start to twiddle my thumbs. Or I'm really pressing them together. So just being aware of some of these, it's kind of nice to have, for me to have a checklist. I kind of move through these things. And then the seventh point is eyes not wide, they're not wide open, but they're relaxed. And there's a soft gaze that's downward, kind of along the bridge of the nose. And so I tend to see kind of reflections with the meditation posture that we have, with the thumbs, but also the lips. The lips have a similar feeling that the thumbs have when they're just touching. And so is the tongue on the roof of the mouth. And beyond this, there's also a text that that I found in the Zen tradition where the nose is aligned with the navel too. The ears are aligned with the hips. And with this, for me, if I really allow myself to be in the posture, and I kind of check back with it now and again, as I might work with the breath, or whatever I'm really working with my practice at the time, I notice that if my posture is upright without being rigid, then my mind can be upright without being rigid. And a lot of times I can't control my mind. It's going all over the place. But working with the body, working with the posture, allows an atmosphere, an opportunity for my mind to settle. And there are also a few kind of deeper aspects of this to me, too. I think a lot of times our body is resisting gravity, and therefore tension arises. And we do this for a long time, and our muscles can get tired and weak. In my background in fitness, there's a lot of talk about postural muscles versus what's called phasic muscles. Postural muscles are ones that really kind of help us be upright as human beings. And phasic muscles are ones that help us move around and do things. And a lot of times what can happen is that, and what happens a lot, is our postural muscles become hyperspastic, they become hyperactive, and they become tight. And a lot of times our phasic muscles become weak. So just to give you an example, a good example of our postural muscles are like our spinal muscles, our hip flexors that connect kind of our torso to our legs, and our calves at the lower leg. A lot of times we don't have to worry about strengthening these so much because they get tight. Like for myself, I go running. I like to run. My hip flexors get tight. My calves tend to get tight. My upper trapezius muscles get tight a lot too. These are all postural muscles. And also, for a lot of people, the pectorals, the chest muscles, these get tight as well. These are postural muscles. So it's still good to strengthen these, but we need to work on stretching them. And a lot of times, I have a background in yoga as well, a little bit, off and on. I've had a flirtatious relationship with it for years. I have to work on really making sure these are open. The phasic muscles, or the ones that move the body, that can become more weak and that we need to strengthen, tend to be like our glutes, you know, right, butt muscles, deltoids, triceps, abdominals, and the lower trapezius, which is the middle of our back. So I think off the cushion for me, working with, so I mentioned I had surgery here and back here, I work with strengthening these phasic muscles and opening these postural muscles. And for me, this has a direct relationship of what I work with on the cushion. When we sit in meditation, a lot of times we don't want to, we're not sitting here trying to aggressively change anything. We're just being aware after we really adjust our posture, check in with it, start working with the breath. But some of these postural muscles are actually accessory muscles for the breath. And they allow a structure to be here for the breath to move freely in and out. So what is it that we're aware of? And how can we affect it a little bit? I think we can. I think we can affect what we work with on the cushion. And this is how I work with my practice overall off the cushion as well. So I hope that's not too technical and that basically makes sense. I saw a couple of heads nodding here and there. But another aspect that I like to work with is I worked with a rolfer for a while. And rolfing is basically if you're not familiar with it, is a form of manual therapy or body work that helps one just be upright as a human being. It kind of recognizes that humans are still understanding what it is to be upright. And so I did this, what's called a 10 series, which I did a series of 10 kind of hour and a half, 2 hour long sessions with Rolfer that worked with certain parts of the body and all these postural muscles and these other muscles too, and deep tissue and fascia as it's around the entire body. Connective tissue. And for me, it absolutely transformed my relationship to my body, which carried over into my practice when I sat. And one central point in Rolfing is called palingenicity. Direct meaning of it is being stretched back and forth, but also unity in opposition. And unity in opposition connects for me with Zen practice right now in that we bring our hands together. And Michael Newhall, who's abbot here recently, was just talking about how a really important teaching of Koban's was that we brought everything together in Gesho. All that I am, you know, positive, negative, confused, awake, everything together. Just like this. Holding the world, bringing everything together. So this concept of palingenicity, I think, translates directly to the posture, directly as who we are as upright beings, and for being upright, as we talk about in the Zen tradition. Directly in that, when we really allow ourselves to feel gravity in the lower half of our body, there is a natural rising that happens in our upper body. And a lot of what we're trying to work with in sitting is managing this bulk of the upper body and helping ourselves relate to gravity. And I think one of the ways we can feel that is, if you want to right now, just try scrunching your sit bones into the ground a little bit and really feeling that and really feeling the weight of gravity in the lower half of your body. And really give yourself to it and just watch what happens to the head, to the shoulders, to the torso. Another example, I think, is you can actually reach forward if you want and just like visualize, like try to see if like your hands can just reach the other side of the wall, of the room, like the other wall. And just notice how that feels. We'll put our hands down. And then try again, but this time, when you do that, feel your shoulder blades, the area between your shoulder blades and the back, and feel your shoulder blades connecting to the wall behind you. And we'll do it one more time. Does that feel different to anybody? I'm getting a couple head nods. More than those couple people? Yeah. This is a good example, I think, of unity and opposition. It's worked with a lot in yoga practice as well. Of being stretched back and forth. So not only from the sit bones to the crown of our head, I think we can work with this in our posture. And I do. I work with this in my posture. But front to back, shoulder to shoulder, side to side. We talked about all Buddhas in the 10 directions earlier. One of our chants here. What was it? All Buddhas, 10 directions, past, present, and future. Yeah. All bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, blah, blah, blah. Right. Well, the 10 directions I looked it up last night. I've thought about it for a while. And I kept reasoning on myself, like, what is 10 directions? What are we talking about, 10 directions? And I'm like, well, the way I could reason out before is north, south, east, west, northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast. And I looked it up on a Buddhist glossary online last night. God bless the internet. And it said, yeah, it's those and plus the zenith and the, what's the opposite of zenith?
Nadir.
Nadir, yeah. So it's above and below. So it's all of those and above and below. So what I've been doing with my posture a lot is, for a long time, just as I approximated these 10 directions, I didn't validate it. What it meant is that north, south, east, west, boom, south, you know, southwest, and whatever, all these other ones too. And then the zenith and then the deer, the crown of the head, the perineum and the sits bones, relating to the center of the earth and the crown of the head. It's classically said being lifted by a light thread. I don't know if many of you have the propensity to be as technical as I have been with the posture. Or I don't know how this lands. This may feel like a lot of information. I figured I'd just use the shotgun approach, load it up, and just spray it and see what happens. What time is it? Are we getting close?
You're in
the clock. On the clock.
12:20.
You could allow for questions or discussion if you want.
Oh yeah, that's my next topic. Anybody have any questions, discussions, critiques, artful critiques? Yes.
Very basic question, mm-hmm. but I can't find the answer. Mm. In just a few sentences, mm. please tell me what.
My first Dharma question.
Sorry.
It's perfect. The best I have right now. I'll give you the best I have right now. That Zen is just simply being who you are. I did it in one sentence. There you go. Couple more? I think Zen offers us a lot of forms, and perhaps you could say methodologies for us to explore that. And there's one thing that comes up when I think about this that one of my first Zen teachers said is that Zen can seem rigid and hard to people. and severe or serious at times. I think this center is a little bit not that much, you know. That's one reason why I like this sangha so much, is that there's a sense of what we're really doing here, and not rather than approximating something. But it can look hard, like the form can seem hard, the practice can seem hard. But what my teacher said was that we're hard. We're hard. And that when you actually puncture it, when you puncture Zen, it's actually very soft. I don't know if that offers anything to you, but that's what comes up too. Thank you. Thanks for your question. Any other questions? Yes?
You said, Sister, that basically Zen says, be who you are.
Mm.
Does that mean you accept who you are, then you stop improving yourself? Mm. Maybe who I am right now is not complete, and there is room for improvement. If I accept who I am, then I set stop wherever I am. Then is there any other explanation that this who is can get better? I don't know if I said it.
This is a great question. Yeah, and I think I understand it. No, really. One of the favorite themes of one of the teachers that I listened to once was titled Spirituality Beyond Self-Improvement. And very much so, it's talked in Buddhist practice that this isn't about self-improvement necessarily. But what we're doing really is taking a good look at what is actually the case. And so I think that very often we want to improve ourselves and we want to change what we see, but we haven't really taken a good look at what that is yet. So I think first, like a lot of, in Zen practice, we face the wall. We face the wall to stop. We just stop whatever we're doing. And we take a look. And it helps us stop. For some reason, just putting a blank wall in front of us. You know, it's not like facing a corner when you got in trouble, you know, and your mom told you to go in your corner. You know, it's, we just stop. And there's all these things that we're doing to ourselves, too. We can be so harsh on ourselves, so hard. It's heartbreaking, actually. Really. We need to look at that. And I think sometimes self-improvement can be, can really get caught up into the kind of consumerist mentality that we're used to, of, I'm not good enough, and I need this. I need to go do this seminar. I need to buy this book. I need to do this system. And I say those systems, some are great. Like, I love Tony Robbins. I think he's fantastic. He helps balance out kind of like, you know, the do-nothingness of Buddhism sometimes in the way that's understood or the way I can mistranslate it to myself. It helps to balance that out. I've found psychotherapy to be very beneficial at times. Very beneficial. And, you know, fitness is all about improving yourself. And I used to work as a personal trainer. So, I think these are all great things, you know. But for me, it's important to just take a look. Take a look. Because a lot of times, if we want to change something, it may not be what we think it is. We have a lot of preconceptions about who we are and what's the case and what that other person is up to and what's wrong with the world and what's wrong with ourselves. But how often do we really just look at what's here? Yeah. I feel like I'm repeating myself now, so I'll stop. But does that answer your question?
In other words, it's connect with yourself. with your inner self and take a look and see who is actually within.
I think you can definitely say that. It's another way of putting it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people can debate semantics about it and finer points, but yeah. Yeah. Like there's a... I'll finish up with... there's something called the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, and I don't think we chanted it very much here. But the last several lines of it are, and it's great to read the whole thing, but it says, turn the light to shine within, then just return. And this is essentially instructions in Zazen in this one. Turn the light to shine within, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. And this is what I love about Zen. There's a paradox there. It can't be faced or turned away from. It just seems. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instruction. And this is the Song of Grass Roof Hermitage. It says, find grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations are only to free you from obstruction. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. If you have any questions about that afterwards, please ask me. It's better to chant the whole thing together. But I just heard the lunch bell. And hopefully this offers you something and also introduces me as somebody who's spending more time here at Chikoji again. And I really appreciate you all being here. And thank you so much for your questions. And it's an honor to practice with you all. From this skin bag to all these other skin bags here. This world of skin bags. They're all coming together. Thank you.